Well, there are various reasons why we might be interested in studying the flux of helicity. A lot of people, including some in this room, have looked at the flux of magnetic helicity from the active sun. I studied the flux of helicity in the quiet sun just to see what the contribution was to the total helicity flux. I have broken this expression into sort of two terms, the mutual and self-helicities, which I'll discuss in much more detail momentarily. The data sets we use to determine the helicity flux are from the SOHO MDI instrument. So we're using line of sight magnetic fields. And this is just a little sidelight, which I'll discuss briefly. A rough outline of the talk, I have to provide some motivation and define a few terms. And then I'll very quickly run through all these things. I have a lot to talk about. So a quick 1 minute tour of solar magnetism. First of all, the magnetic field is the only game in town if you're studying the sun. There's not a whole lot else. It's terribly exciting. We tend to group fields on the sun into two classes. One, the active sun, which sort of follows the well-known solar cycle. And then the quiet sun, which seems to be sort of ubiquitous, omnipresent. People can argue about spatial distributions of quiet sun fluxes, but this is really very poorly constrained right now by observational studies. The MDI instrument has really been helpful because there's a long time history of a lot of data there. But people really need to go and look at that before we can say much more that's quantitative about that. If you estimate the amount of flux, some whole cycle estimates the amount of flux in the active sun come out to about 10 to the 24th Maxwells. You get comparable numbers for the whole cycle quiet sun flux if you buy Carl Shriver's 40-hour turnover time and you associate that turnover time with the generation of new flux, not just the recycling of old flux.
Are you talking now sometimes about 40 and 50 hertz?
I know that recently they've thought that their emergence rates were much quicker than they previously thought, so that would correspond to what you're saying.
Like the latitude.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Whether it's, you know, remnant active regions or whatever.
Yeah, it's ongoing research for them though, and they are constantly coming out with new results. So.
I guess my question too is, how do you know whether it's real, whether it's having new flux, whether it's really recycled?
In a paper he published a few years ago on this magnetochemistry, as he called it, he tried to make arguments about what the distribution of fluxes would look like if you were reprocessing flux as opposed to if you were generating new flux. A synopsis, a 20-word synopsis of that argument eludes me right now, but he seems to think that there's a way to do it. I'm actually not sure what his feeling on the subject is, though.
Essentially, if you equate the kind of rate of emergence of flux that you see, with the amount of flux that you see on the sun, and assume it's a steady state, get a rough lifetime.
Yeah, which you would say is the same flux coming up over and over.
It may be. Well, it may well be. I mean, you could actually have stuff coming and going, couldn't you? Sinking down below.
Right. And the turbulent layer right there, that's almost exactly what you'd expect. No sweat. So let's talk a little bit about magnetic helicity. It's probably well known to most people here. When somebody says magnetic helicity, this is usually what I think of, and this I think is probably the colloquial understanding of the term. There's a complication, though. This definition of the magnetic helicity is not gauge invariant when the bounding surface of this volume and the volume integral is not a magnetic surface. That is, when the normal component of the magnetic field vanishes on that surface, this quantity is not gauge invariant. Well, this obtains on the sun in response to this Bergeron field defined a relative helicity. People are getting more comfortable with this all the time. The relative helicity gets rid of the gauge invariance by using the magnetic field that matches the normal component of the magnetic field on the boundary, the potential field version of that, and its potential, vector potential, as reference fields. It's important to understand that these two quantities are merely fictitious and can be entirely determined by the boundary condition. The real fields of interest are the A and the B here. These are only used as reference fields. This is entirely analogous to defining a zero of potential energy and then the relative magnetic helicity just quantifies a departure from your zero. Okay, so why would we care about the helicity flux? Alexander and Sasha, I know, are working on this now, and along with Alexander's postdoc. Axel and, and Alexander are working on this now. There are also questions about coronal heating. The expression for the magnetic helicity, which I put up, some models of coronal heating require quiet sun fluxes to generate the heat. This little term here means that the that fields which have a non-zero relative magnetic helicity must perforce be different from the potential field. In that sense, they have free energy. The potential field is the minimum state of minimum energy. So any field with magnetic helicity must have some currents flowing, must therefore have some free energy, which might have implications for coronal heating. Further, it's unclear what actually happens to active region fluxes, whether they just diffuse over time and populate the quiet sun flux, or whether there's a small dynamo operating in the turbulent upper layer of the convection zone, which generates the quiet sun field. It might be the case that by studying the distributions of helicity flux, we might infer that maybe active region flux is ultimately responsible for the generation of fields in the quiet sun. Okay, so what did I set out to do? I set out to measure the flux of magnetic helicity through the photosphere. Oh, dear. The photosphere is one place where we have reasonably good estimates of the magnetic field strength. In my theoretical developments, I'm going to be using MDI data. I'm going to be using MDI high-resolution data. The field of view is a small window about...
We don't measure the Z. We measure line of sight, which consists
yes, of yes, components. Yes, that's right. Especially, I'm making a parallel plane approximation. I'm going to assume that when I see something, it is line of sight. I was going to say that the MDI window covers a small patch near disk center, but there is a slight departure from sort of a plane parallel approximation that I'm making in the actual data. So I am measuring the line of sight magnetic field, and I'm taking that as BZ. That is an approximation. The rate of helicity flux through the photosphere has two terms. So this is the flux of helicity into the corona from the photosphere. Therefore, it has a minus sign with respect to a lot of things you see published. But this term I call the advection term, or the emergence term. That course that arises from this little normal velocity. This is the bulk transport of fields which already contain helicity into the volume of the corona. This term, which is the term that I'm actually going to be interested in, I call the braiding term or the winding term. Some other authors have called it the shearing term. It is the generation of helicity from surface motions. It's not really the generation of helicity. It's the transport of helicity of one side up and the opposite side down. This term, the term which I'm neglecting, while here I make some noise about saying it's relevant for active regions, this is a cop-out. The real reason that we've ignored this term is that if you're looking at the quiet sun, measurements of tangential fields, which you need here, are very noisy. It's very difficult to get high cadence measurements, which I'm going to have to do if I'm going to keep track of the flux of helicity over time with vector magnetograms.
How did A disappear from the equation?
How did what?
The real...
That's a good question. This magnetic, the potential field, the B sub P, is the magnetic field which satisfies the same boundary condition as the real field, the same normal field boundary condition. Normal field is an integral curve, or an integral around a curve of I'm trying to say a contour integral of the vector potential gives you the flux through that field. So it is the case that on the boundary AP and A are identical. Their tangential components are identical. So this really is A on the boundary, and that's by construction of what the relative helicity is. The normal component of A sub P vanishes. The knowable component of the real A does not, if there's a tangential field. Do I need to say anything else here? So I should pull this back down. So I'm going to chuck this term and keep track of this term. Cusano and some other people published or presented some results at the Yoko 10 meeting suggesting that this term, at least in active regions, is as important as this term, which severely constrains the interpretation of my results.
So, I mean, typically in the quiet sun, most of the flux emerges in the form of ephemeral regions.
That's right.
Then migrate to the boundaries and fragment and so on. So you're essentially neglecting the emergence of any felicity within the ephemeral region. You're trying to find out how much felicity is added by the subsequent processing of that flux.
Precisely.
On average. On average.
Yeah, sure.
He might not neglect locally, but if felicity has plus or minus, it takes integral or what?
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
So it's less constrained.
In a way, I prefer the word emergence to advection, because, I mean, the other one is advection as well.
Yes, you're advecting fluxes so, sideways and stuff like that. That's right.
So
yeah.
Probably a better word, really.
It's very dubious assumption.
In practice, I use those terms simultaneously and, or not simultaneously, interchangeably, and not so good. This is an image of one of the data sets that I used. I ended up tracking 5 data sets. It's peppered with little fluxes, which don't appear to have much order. To a first order approximation, I'm going to take these as point sources of magnetic flux, little delta functions of magnetic flux. If that's true, then it's easy to find out what the vector potential arising from each one of these little flux elements is. And in fact, on the surface, the vector potential, which I've drawn here in red, is circumferential. This gives you the flavor of how a winding motion about the location of the flux element will lead to the winding of field lines. These are field lines, and essentially, helicity is a measure of that winding. Combining those two terms, expression for the point-like sources of the magnetic field and the vector potential, you can break the helicity flux, just the what I was calling the braiding or winding term, into two parts. One which is the, which I'm calling the mutual helicity, which is the winding of distinct flux elements about each other, distinct and disparate. They are separated in space about each other, and the winding of, or should I say, the distortion of individual flux elements about their own axes. So there are really sort of two stories to tell. I'll get to that in a minute. That was just my first approximation, was just to get me to this spot. I'll look at things a little more closely in a moment. I'm not going to talk about mutual helicity. I can do that with anybody who's interested, but I don't really have time to fully elaborate on both of these things. I guess I will talk about it a little bit. I'll retract and say, if you evaluate the expression I showed on the previous page for this, the mutual helicity, you just see that the rate is in two flux elements, say, it would just be the product of the fluxes times the angular velocity of by which the fluxes rotate about each other, and this factor from the definition of helicity. We expect that this actually happens from the differential rotation. If you take an initially co-longitudinal line of points and map them after one middle-latitude differential rotation, you see that flux elements equatorward and poleward of an observer stationed at this point would rotate in a sort of a right-handed sense with respect to an outward normal about that observer's location. So there is expected to be some mutual helicity flux. It's not clear at all if there's expected to be any sort of systematic tendency to have self-helicity flux. I mentioned before that I was approximating things as point sources, and Vahe busted me that, you know, how can you talk about point sources rotating well about their own axes? Well, really, the flux doesn't originate from point sources. And if you look at things very closely, you can figure out that they have structure. So for each flux element in my data set, I define its average position and then define a local coordinate system with reference to some global coordinate system. And in that little coordinate system, I look at the structure of the flux elements. You can represent, why is this always crooked? You can represent the spatial distribution of flux by these azimuthally orthogonal expansion functions. Essentially, these give you the quadrupole moments of the shape of the flux distribution. So I'm going to start using these terms, which I'm defining capital Fs and capital Gs, which I use as proxies for shapes. Something that is azimuthally symmetric has sort of zero F2 and G2 moments. It has a non-zero F0 moment. The F0 mode is the azimuthally symmetric mode. A positive F2 mode corresponds to something that runs left and right. A negative F2 is something that runs up and down. A positive G, which I've shown here in white, is something that runs this way. A negative G would run that way. I can essentially, using these methods, describe a flux element of arbitrary shape. The expression for the self-helicity flux that I put up there before had information about the shape of the flux element. It also had information about the velocity field in which the flux element finds itself. If you expand the velocity field about the flux-weighted position of the flux element, you can write the velocity field as a sum of different. You can write the Jacobian matrix essentially as a sum of different terms. Each term corresponds to a different sort of elemental flow. In the co-moving frame with these four flows, I can represent an arbitrary flow pattern. And then if I have a fortuitous combination of certain flow patterns and flux distributions, there will be a non-zero helicity flux. It's quantified by this expression. First of all, if I have an arbitrarily shaped flux element that's in a circulating flow, field lines will wind around each other. If I have a flux element that extends in this direction and finds itself in a particularly oriented stagnation flow, then these two lobes of the flux element will poke out into the flow which tends to rotate the flux element in a counterclockwise fashion, whereas the countervailing flow elements which would tend to rotate the flow in the other way, well, there's no flux element there. So this flow, on the average, would tend to rotate this flux element this way. This flow, we have a rotated flux element and a rotated stagnation flow, would tend to rotate the flux element that way. This, which is a diverging flow, might actually signal the emergence or submergence of magnetic fields, which could contain helicity. But by just looking at the shape of a flux element, I won't actually be able to know that.
Are you saying that if you watch the flux element change shape, that you can know how it's being twisted by the velocity field?
You're a straight man. I can. I should have. Yeah, exactly. That's can I measure, if I just watch the shape of flux elements, if I just watch this, the distribution, it's a function of time, can I measure these flow components? Because this is all I've got. Well, there is a relation between these and this, because the change in a flux element shape depends upon the flow in which it finds itself. I can look at the time rate of change of flux element shapes and make some arguments about how that shape should evolve depending upon the flow. And you come up with something down here, a big system of equations. The idea is that these are flow components. They act broadly on what I've defined here as the shape matrix, or these are essentially characterize the shape of a function. These flows convolved with these shapes lead to changes in the shapes as a function of time. So the idea is that perhaps by watching the change in shape of a flux element, I can work backwards. By watching this and keeping track of this, I can figure out this. The problem is I've got four unknowns and only three observables. Essentially, the root of this difficulty is that it's difficult to tell if a circle is rotating if you look at it from above. Nonetheless, perhaps foolishly, I aim to try.
Why the unknowns only 4 because you're ignoring G3 and F3 alone?
Pardon me? I'm not sure you could close the system by keeping higher order moments, at least if you wanted to get the helicity flux, because there would be higher order contributions for the flow field, because I only kept the first order derivatives in the flow field. We just kept the first order term. So you're suggesting that I go to second order in shape distributions, and I'm saying that would only introduce second order contributions from flow components. So you'd make your problem. I don't think you'd get anywhere really. Okay. So what I do have is a time series of flux element shapes. At each instant in time, a given shape, suppose this is a shape at one flux element at time one, there is some flow which lies in the null space of the shape matrix. And by lying in the null space, I mean this flow will not alter any of the components of the shape matrix. All it does is essentially streamlines are parallel to the boundary of the flow, so that flow will never change shape. So I call this a null flow. Unfortunately, if there really were a flux element like this in this null flow, the streamlines, of course, penetrate into the center of the flux element. There would be a winding of field lines, so there would be helicity flux from that. So that would inject helicity. So I've got to make some attempt to quantify the null flow. It is the case, however, that as the shape of a flux element evolves, so does the null flow for that flux element at each moment in time. So a flux element that initially looked like this, which had this null flow, and at some later time, say, looked like this and had this null flow, I can say with certainty that this flow did not exist to get this flux element to look like that. There must have been some other flow present. Conversely, you know, the flow that made this thing, that caused this thing to end up looking like this, did not look like this. Then suppose at some later time this flux element looks like this. It is not the case that this flow was present to distort this flux element into this shape. So the idea is that if by using a long time series of observations of flux element shapes, you can constrain what the null flows are.
Wait, let me ask you. You can see the stationary flow of 4 types. But what we have on the sun, one type of flow goes into another.
Mm-hmm.
So you have convection cell, and it first spreads the field, and then gets into these points between cells, mm-hmm. and you have quadruple, and so on. Even if you follow your disease, in time, it will jump from one of your types to another type.
Yeah, and I am always working in the co-moving frame, so that the large scale flow that's advecting these things to the flow boundaries,
In the same flow.
The large scale flow shouldn't matter. It's the local flow that's distorting the thing as it's being advected along. Then once I get to the intergranular lanes, then presumably it just sits there, and that flow can change as a function of time. That's right.
So you do not consider a transfer magnetic element through sequence of your 4 types of flows, right?
I'm not sure I understand your criticism.
It's not criticism, it's a question. Sun does it.
The sun does, yes. It advects them along, and the flow.
In your theory, you separately consider 4 types of stationary flows.
That's right.
And this is not the sun.
I don't understand what other flows are present in the sun that I have not taken into account.
You emerge with some magnetic element.
Yes.
Then you have the flow which diverging, which was on your right, not this.
Yeah.
And then it goes to the boundary, mm-hmm. and then you have this type of flow. Then goes intergranular, whatever boundary. It has quadruple, whatever type of flow. The same element.
That's right.
Goes through all the types.
That's right.
In a non-stationary way.
That's right.
That's not the game you play.
Pardon me?
It's not the game you're playing.
In fact, I have to make some.
No, he sticks with one of these.
Actually, I don't.
No. Okay.
So you can find what the null flow is at each time step by singular value decomposition. We use a relaxation algorithm to add null flow back in to minimize the time derivatives of the flow components. It's actually the square of the time derivatives. So in some sense, I am doing what Sasser says. If there were one flow pattern that could represent the time evolution of the flow for all its around a flux element for all its history, my algorithm would select that flow and say that is the correct answer. But in fact, the data constrain things more tightly than that. You can't ever represent everything with just one flow. So there are some things that are well constrained by the data, and I must follow those points. Let me talk a little bit about this relaxation algorithm, because this is a central part of things. As I said before, I must of necessity try to estimate the null flow. To demonstrate why I had to do that, before we decided on using this relaxation algorithm, I thought I'd take this slightly pudgy simulated data set, slightly pudgy ellipse here, it's a little more extended in this direction, and rotate it and see if my inversion algorithm could find the right answer. And without the relaxation algorithm, it did not. These are the time series of the quadrupole moments. I've only got a finite number of pixels, and that's why you see these little jags. But essentially, the labeling algorithm and the thing that's keeping track of the structure is working accurately. It's telling me that the thing is rotating. The flow that I actually imposed on the thing was just a curl flow, what I'm calling a C flow, just a circulation flow. The inversion algorithm, however, without the relaxation.
Can you explain what relaxation algorithm means more specifically?
Yes, yes. So that was going to be my next slide, but I might as well do it now so that you understand what's going on. This is with a simulated data set I just showed you. These are the four components of the flow that I talked about before. This is a particular stagnation flow, a T flow, that's on this little line here. This is another stagnation flow, which is on this line and oscillates very rapidly. This is the curl flow, the thing that I actually imposed on the thing, and this is the diverging flow, which is zero, set to zero at the back. At each time step, so there are sort of four slices of the flows here, time runs this way. At each time step, the singular value decomposition routine gives me the null space. And because my test flux element was mostly circular, the null space is mostly in the circulating flow, because the data do not constrain that flow very well at all. The relaxation algorithm takes components from this, takes vectors from this at each time step, adds it to that in order to minimize the time derivatives. Sees if there's an improvement. If it is, it adds more. If there is, it adds more. So by adding this to this in lots of little steps, you essentially get this, which is the right answer in this test case.
I'm still not quite get the point. On the sun, you don't have tons of times to relax. You have a short time to transport your element to the boundaries. And so everything, and then the cell dies, it's another time. When you talk about relaxation, what kind of time units do you mean?
This isn't real time, this is simulated time, right? This could be hours and hours of data, which I will eventually do, and then I will relax the thing over that time scale. So I think
the scale of lifetime of
flux. Yes, exactly. So these sort of several hours sort of time scales.
It lives 2 days.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what the relaxation algorithm is doing. So that's one way I can show you what the relaxation algorithm has done. The other way is to show you this, which I originally put up. Initially, the answer, the inverted flow had the stagnation flows oscillating in time. The relaxation algorithm essentially adds coefficients of the null space. This is the time series of coefficients from the null space. I think in absolute value, you'd see that they're all up at one. Essentially minimizes these curves down to zero. And initially, the inversion algorithm found this, which is exactly the wrong answer. After the relaxation, it found the right answer. Yes?
What is plotted on this board?
Pardon me?
What
Oh, I'm sorry. So this is, there are four components of the flow. This is one stagnation flow oriented this way. This is another stagnation flow oriented at 45 degrees to that. This is the curl flow. And this is time. So this is simulated time because I was just doing a simulated thing.
This is the relative temperature of this
flow. That's right. That's right. That's right. And this is the diverging flow, which is at machine noise. This is the time series of quadrupole moments. And this was the coefficient of the null space at each time step that was used to get from this down to that. That's, I might as well leave that off. It conveys no useful information.
What you're saying is you only have one kind of flow and that's the C flow.
That's right. I caused a simulated flux element to rotate. And my algorithm initially told me that it's not rotating. It's got crazy time-varying stagnation flows that are causing it to contort in just such a way as to give the to represent the data. There are other ways I could have tried to estimate the null flow. I could have said, well, I could have said the null flow is not there.
Can you say what kind of data do you mean?
Well, that was simulated data. I just took a fake magnetogram signal and rotated it. What I'm actually...
Did you use Doppler
guns? No.
Because you're talking about flaws, and flaws measured in some sense.
Yeah, well, there are flaws that are inferred from tracking. Flows that are inferred from tracking, and importantly, they're perpendicular to the line of sight, so I couldn't use Doppler grams.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I guess on the limb and stuff like that, but yeah. There are other things I could have done to estimate the null flow. I could have said that the null flow is an equipartition with the observed flow, that, you know, find the amount of energy that's in those other flows and say that one-fourth of it, one-third of that number, I guess, is in the null flow, but this seems less ad hoc. Okay, so what do I actually need to do to do this on the sun? Label and track fluxes and use my black boxes to keep track of things. What am I doing on time? These are three data sets, or pardon me, four data sets, tracked for something like 15 hours, about 22 hours, and 15 hours, and then another data set tracked for 7.5 hours. It was problematic to keep active region fields from rotating into the field of view. Okay, so I've talked before that I was using a SOHO MDI line of sight magnetograms. I'm using a high resolution instrument mode, so my pixels are 440 kilometers on a side. As such, the scale of a granule is about 2 pixels. My flux elements have, as I'll talk about in a minute, have a minimum size of about 10 pixels, and their median size is about 60 pixels. So the granular flows are on scales smaller than what I'm keeping track of when I'm keeping track of the evolution of flux elements. To improve signal to noise, we took 5-minute averages. Things are smoothed following a...
So where is 4 Gauss came from? The MDI accuracy is 15 Gauss.
So where is what?
MDI accuracy is sort of 15 Gauss.
And where
you
does...
You put some 4 Gauss in
Oh, this is in order to estimate the noise, we took the width of this, of the sort of the core of things here, and we said that's all noise.
MDI is very noisy.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know.
Why. I would.
Why people like it so much. We have much better ground observations.
Yeah, I, the reason I liked it was that there was, you know, 15 hours of 20 hours of data. Yeah, very high cadence.
In the sense of null,
be careful. Yeah. And I would actually be very inclined to think that the noise is, I'm not very impressed with the inversion algorithm I think it's that they use. I think it's wrong in both weak fields and at strong fields. To label things, Dana wrote a nifty one-pass flux-ranked uphill gradient method. I won't get into details, but it's very quick and labels little convex groupings of flux elements. I don't know if you can see the little asterisks here. This is one flux element. In a full image, we got about 500 flux elements. I recorded the shape and structure of things at each step. I guess I should digress for a moment and say this is essentially an azimuthally symmetric flux element. It's the flux element viewed from overhead, the pixels that have been grouped there. To give you an idea of some of the variety that's present, though, show you a few things here. This is a flux element that's been smooshed up against a couple others. It's grouped as one because it's convex about that peak. It runs mainly in this direction. Here's another one that's in front of a much larger one. There's a saddle between the two. Because of that saddle, the flux element is sort of distended in that direction, so it has a G mode. This is what I would call it, F mode.
Sorry, are you saying you're calling those one element?
Yeah, this is one, as opposed to, say, three.
Yeah.
Mandy Hagener's tracking algorithm, she said, would call that one.
Yeah.
And I guess I would call it three, actually, because there are three little peaks.
So how come the little pink thing doesn't seem to show three?
Pardon me? Because I'm only showing this one.
Oh, I see.
I'm only showing an isolated flux element. And this is one way that you get structure.
Yeah.
Along the way, I made a plot of the distribution of flux element shapes to prove to myself that they were random, and I found out that they weren't. In particular, there seems to be, all my data sets have predominantly northern hemisphere coverage. The equator always sort of lies at the southern end of things. There seems to be a predominance of flux elements that have that orientation. There's a slight tendency for an enhancement of vertical flux elements over horizontal ones, but this is very strong. Here, these are three sigma departures of these Gaussians from zero. I actually... yeah, the equator would be down here. North is up. I tried to characterize this as a function of latitude, but it was pretty noisy. I think I will go back and do that eventually. But like I say, all my data sets have predominantly northern hemisphere coverage. So that the equator was essentially at the bottom or near the bottom in all my data sets.
Stretch in this direction because...
In order to verify that it was really there.
Rotation would stretch in different way.
Yeah, rotation would.
But those are too small for differential rotation.
Yeah, I would think rotation would cause things to eventually look like that. But this is three sigma. When I use all the data sets from all the flux elements from all time steps of any one run, it becomes like a 20 or 30 sigma result. It's really there. In order to make sure it wasn't some artifact of my labeling algorithm, I took data sets and flipped them in different directions and made sure that the asymmetries mapped as you'd think they were if they were inherent in the data, and they did.
How big are those relative to this? What scale?
So 60 pixels. So this is something like, a scale length would be 8 pixels. And they're...
Where is that your bipole? Can you put plus minus field?
No, this is a monopole.
But the bipole will be another.
I haven't kept track of that at all.
Because
that might be interesting.
Ephemeral regions are emerging as bipoles.
How do you know what's connected to what?
Yeah,
and these things are constantly fragmenting and colliding and.
Well, initially, when they're born, they're.
That's true.
For a certain amount of time.
That's true. And I can
there's also a variation in time, the shape.
That's true. I can tell when a flux element was created in the data that I've stored. So I can look at.
Well, I mean just saying the ephemeral regions when they're born originally.
So how do you know
they're
close together, yeah. They're very close together and they move apart.
You can see on magnetogram plus minus.
And they move apart.
Yeah, I know, but you see my measure, but it has to be some sort of qualitative measure at the distance. Close together.
Well, they're in my data set, and then they're not in my data set, pardon me, and then they are, so I know that they've recently emerged. Now I have to take into account the fact that things can rotate in and rotate out, and I also have to take into account the fact that I've got a 10 Gauss threshold, and things can be sort of converged or something, or intensified, and pop above my threshold, and then disperse and drop below my threshold.
Let's raise a question. if you can see the bipole, and you're interested in one piece which is shared and create helicity, it's not independent on the other guy, because this is one magnetic element. So that questions how your result are relevant, or you have to double your result, or they twist in the opposite direction, move your.
But as I think, as long as I'm just taking the algebraic sum of things, as long as I've got the helicity flux in the right, as long as I got my signs all correctly, if I'm rotating one in such a sense that it will cancel with the other, when I add them together, that should come out in the wash.
It's one of them, isn't it? Not an easy matter. What did you find for the lifetime of your?
I didn't actually. I wasn't actually interested in that, so I didn't compute that.
It's an interesting question.
It's there in my data. I haven't bothered to extract it.
We interrupted you. You're trying to answer Eric's question about the size.
Oh, that's right. So a typical radius is about 8 pixels.
Yes.
They're 45 or 450 kilometers. So a typical radius is 3,500 kilometers, which is what, 5 arc seconds?
Yeah, and how much is the elevation? You know, what's the aspect ratio of the ellipse?
I can talk about the outliers, or I can talk about where the centroid is. And the centroid is not displaced from much, 0.2. And I weighted by the sort of the relevant azimuthal mode.
So they're fairly circular.
They're fairly circular.
Can you still understand? If I have this bipole,
mm-hmm.
and on one end you have create say positive helicity,
mm-hmm.
on the other end you create say, because field is go opposite. Positive will look like negative. You sum them, but they're compensating in fact each other.
The helicity flux term for the self flux goes as the flux squared times the
for a single element.
For a single element.
I have his companion.
So I'm saying if they're both rotating in the same sense, you're going to be winding things up.
But they have different direction of field, opposite direction. In one element, field goes out of the sun.
I think if I rotate something this way and
because you take the dipole and twist them both the same way, you're twisting it with you.
Okay. There's no.
Okay, what else? Obscure tracking results. I plotted the rotation speeds as a function of latitude and also the meridional flow. I know some people are occasionally interested in that. This is the Snodgrass photospheric differential rotation rate. I believe he used an iron line, which is supposed to be magnetically sensitive. I'm getting things rotating subdiffusively, and I do that in every data set. This is typical. I think that's interesting. I believe that Bob Howard has shown that active region fields rotate, sub-differentially. Active region fields rotate super-differentially. So it might be the case that something, this might say something about where these fields are anchored. Or I don't understand the reason why, because I think essentially that, I don't understand the discrepancy between my results and Snodgrass is because what I'm essentially saying is that the centroid of this distribution, if you looked at latitudinal bins, the centroid in each latitudinal bin would be below this curve that Snodgrass has drawn. I think they should measure essentially the same thing. The meridional flows are about the same in every case, and we're about 10 meters per second northward. Again, I have primarily northern hemispheric coverage. Okay, so getting onto the meat, what I set out to measure, the self-helicity, this is one flux element. This is the time series of its data set. This is 185 minute step, so it's 15 hours. There's an inverted velocity, four components of the inverted velocity at each time step. This is the null flow at each time step. This is presumably a fairly circular flux element, so the null flow is not constrained. Applying the relaxation algorithm to the initial data set essentially introduces some circulating or curling flow, but doesn't change much of the other flows that you see, these little spikes, because those are constrained by the data. What about, let's look at that in another way. And here it's very glaring what the algorithm has done. This is the time evolution of the quadrupole moments. Notice they've got these spikes. I'll talk about them in a minute. Here, again, are different flows as a function of time. Time runs horizontally. This is one stagnation flow. This is another stagnation flow. This is what I'm calling the curl flow, and essentially it's not present at all initially, but after the application of the relaxation algorithm, this dashed line is what's put out. So evidently the relaxation algorithm is saying that the presence of this flow best explains the time evolution of this particular flux element under the assumption that the flow is as constant as it can be. What about all those spikes? Do they correspond to anything real? I can put up a couple examples where I looked at things. On this plot, I've shown the time series of the quadrupole moments. You can see they've got these spikes. I've also shown up here in the history of this flux element, when it collided, I put a little C, and when it fragmented, I put a little F. I've also shown sort of missing data when the 5-minute cadence was off by more than 30 seconds, or bad magnetograms. But you can essentially see that for every one of these sort of spikes in the quadrupole moments, there was a collision or a fragmentation. That shows up down here. Well, what do I want to look at first? That shows up down here where I've plotted these two stagnation flows, and you can see these things sort of oscillating wildly. I think this is essentially one flux element, the one I tracked, and a neighboring flux element sort of banging heads, oscillating, colliding and fragmenting and colliding and fragmenting and colliding and fragmenting. When they collide and fragment, the largest parent keeps essentially the name of the result, the child flux, keeps the name of the largest parent. When they fragment, similarly, the largest offspring keeps the name of the parent. So essentially, this is probably the larger of the two flux elements that was banging heads. I looked at other examples too, and it does seem that all these spikes that show up in the inverted velocities do correspond to sort of significant events like fragmentations or something in the history of these flux elements. This does actually enter into the self-helicity flux. These spikes are present in all things. If I look at the self-helicity flux for a couple different flux elements, so this is time. This is one particular flux element. You can see that there's this long, several hours trend. On another one, this is actually one I looked at a moment ago with the spikes. You can see there is, again, a long time scale trend, but the error bars between the two are quite large. Evidently, in some cases, the inversion is not very robust.
Inversion gives you error bars then?
I took the measured quadrupole moments, perturbed them by their errors with a pseudo-random sequence of numbers, and ran the inversion procedure again. Did that 25 times, and so I Monte Carlo to get those error bars. And that sort of captures the lack of, I don't want to say robustness, lack of stability in the inversion scheme in particular cases. What I was really after, let's see, that's not what I want to show you.
Mean-free paths quite smooth, isn't it?
Pardon me?
Mean-free path, as it were, between elements is quite small. You're getting quite a lot of collisions.
In that case.
Period.
In that case, yeah. They were probably caught in an intergranular lane and were just getting buffeted by the turbulence.
Right.
In others, you know, I haven't actually bothered to do that. I think, well, I can show you this. this is just a map of the labels.
Right.
And you can see that they, I don't know if it takes you a few seconds, but your eye can start to see the supergranulation pattern, the clustering at vertices of supergranules. There are just these large field-free regions. And at the vertices, you see little clusters of things.
So was the typical flux about 10 to the 18 maxwells in your
element? About 3 times 10 to the 8, almost exactly what Carl Shriver
was saying. It would also be interesting to know, you know, what the flows that you come out with, how they vary with location in the, you know, relative to supergranular, you know, the cell.
That's
true. Or the junctions, for example.
That's true. About all I thought about doing was characterizing it as a function of latitude or something like that to see if there's anything there. But that would be a very good idea. This is a time series from one of the data sets of all the flux elements. Their cell felicities all added up. You can see the error bars here are even larger. In this case, just by eye, you can tell that I could draw a line through zero and say there is no cell felicity flux. The average in this, I think, is probably slightly displaced from zero one way or another, and in every data set I had, the error bars were, of course, consistent with fluctuations about the average. So now this, just for the sake of putting it up, is the Fourier transform of this to see if you saw anything interesting there. And so I didn't get a whole lot out of looking at those. The other thing I was interested in was see if there was any sort of latitudinal dependence on flux element latitude. And so for each flux element, in each data set, I found its average cell felicity flux, and I plotted that as a function of latitude. This is for one data set. They look essentially the same for every other data set. There's structure, but nothing that makes any sense. So I don't think that there just really is no systematic cell felicity flux that I can detect with this method. And there is no systematic tendency to the cell felicity flux.
What are those large departures from zero then?
I mean, it's there, but I can't explain it in any systematic terms. I don't know why it's large and positive here and large and positive here, and right next to it it's small and negative. I don't have any other than just say that local conditions maybe were causing this.
So you don't, even though that might be statistically significant,
you don't have confidence. Yeah. Well, I don't understand its interpretation, I guess is what's really going on. And I'm not confident with these ALA bars here. Pardon me?
What don't you understand? The scale of variation is wrong?
I don't have at hand a physical explanation for, a physical interpretation for what this means. But
you don't expect such a large felicity for such a small scale like that to vary from one pixel to the next that rapidly, is that why?
Another problem is that these error bars, and I've looked at these a couple times and tried to figure out if I made a mistake, but they would not make me think that this variation is appropriate. It is random, should I say.
So where can you be random?
You're saying that the signal itself is inherently noisy.
Yeah,
I can buy that.
What was your preconceived expectation of this plot?
It would have been interesting if there had been some latitudinal variation.
Just because of the
variation,
Tonic
variation.
Yeah. I can show you the others, and they really are just bereft of anything useful. So these are for all 5 data sets. Raise that up. And see, here the error bars are much larger, and I'm sort of happy with that being essentially zero, but Fahey's point is taken that it could just be an intrinsic variability in the source.
It'd be interesting to know whether there's any correlation with position, you know, in the sense that, you know, is there more self-felicity in downflow regions?
I know that.
Junctions.
I think that
you might get a concentration of felicity.
It's been demonstrated that there are.
If you're living for as long as 15 hours, you know that's starting to come in.
It's been demonstrated that there are correlations between converging flows and circulation patterns, so that probably is true. I haven't had time to look at that yet.
So if you just picked out the ones that were in the downflows.
Yeah. And I guess you'd have to do that by saying ones that are sort of in clusters, which you presume to be downflows. So this is the rate I saw, the average rate, which I say is essentially consistent with zero, given the error bars. The fluctuations were of this order, 10 to the 33rd. I did make a prediction that was based upon, you know, just some, just the shear you'd expect from differential rotation. I thought there might actually be sort of a cascade of kinetic helicity to smaller scales, which might manifest itself in the scales at which these flows are, but didn't see anything there. Of note, flux element shapes are not random, slightly. And just because I didn't talk with you guys at all about mutual helicity flux, I...
What is this number compared to friction helicity rate?
You have to be careful. So this is the average self-helicity flux in a...
Much smaller, right?
Much smaller, yeah. You have to be careful how you can look at things, though, because you have to sum up many of these little flux elements to cover the same amount of space as an active region. So I guess it would be most useful if I had something up there in per centimeter instead of per flux element.
It was niche. It was 10 to the 40-something for... We use real magnetograms.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems to be this... femoral region do not contribute much to the balance, right?
Yeah, that's a fair statement. In the self helicity flux, I didn't talk at all about mutual helicity flux, which I also measured, and that's a much more robust result. This is from a paper that Che published using MDI data as well for an active region, and just as Alexander has said, the rate is, well, he's at 10 to the 40 per hour, so 10 to the 37th. Much higher.
Didn't count emerging.
That's right.
Which might be the major.
And it seems that this paper of Cusano suggested that at least in the active region case, it's comparable to the.
I expect that this is a major danger.
So is your, I guess you didn't talk about the quiet self-helicity conditions here, except just what I usually compare. Are they also still consistent with zero?
Let me see if I have a. They are not. They are consistent with, as Fahy said, intrinsic variability in the source. That's a time series of mutual helicity flux. So this is the rate of winding of flux elements, distinct flux elements about each other, and you can see that the error bars are quite small. But it does seem that the thing is, and this is a Fourier transform of that plot, it does seem that things are essentially random. This does have a latitudinal trend, just from the differential rotation. But the average in your field of view depends upon the relative numbers of positive and negative fluxes in your field of view, so that causes the sign to fluctuate. I think if you did a whole cycle azimuthal average, you'd come up with 10 to the 43 Maxwells per cycle of mutual helicity flux. I'm not not very clear on how to go from helicity flux to energy. There certainly is energy going in because there is helicity flux, but I'm not. It's not clear how to convert that into a pointing flux or something easily. So difficult to put bounds on that.
So, I mean, how do you? That looks. I mean, just by eyeball, that looks close to zero with fluctuations around it. So how do you square that with a picture that you've got? This broad distribution of flux, which is being sheared by differential rotation, which you would think would generate helicity.
That's what I'm saying. It does generate.
But not self-helicity.
Yeah, not self-helicity. Yeah, this is mutual helicity. It does. The answer you get for your field of view depends upon the relative numbers of positives and negatives in the field of view, because that. So this was for the self-helicity. For the mutual helicity. For the mutual helicity, it depends on the product of the fluxes. So if they're the same sign, you get positive helicity, and if they're the opposite sign, you get negative helicity, even if they're all rotating with the same sense.
But surely, if you integrate over the sun,
Exactly. You'd have to watch in azimuth, you'd have to integrate. And I never did. You know, I just have a field of view that I track for a few hours. And the imbalance of positives and negatives that rotated into and out of my field of view was omnipresent and large. There were a few hundred flux elements, and something like 100 was the disparity between positive and negative flux elements.
There is a different application of this result. It, from the point of view of balance of helicity, how much the sediment contributed, looks like little. But are those elements are important for the coronal heating problem. We have another paper with Mitch, which you're probably not familiar with, in which we can see the ephemeral regions, how they contribute into coronal heating. Because if you take now into account reconnections, then helicity, actual topology, greatly constrains the energy release through reconnections. And in fact, we included all topological invariants. But because you have explicit numbers for the helicity, you can try to clarify this point. So when I'm talking the power release, when these small elements reconnect and contributing to the coronal heating, it's constrained by helicity.
Yes.
So look at this problem. You might find something.
Yeah, I will go to
not
Mitch's
balance,
reprint page.
Balance but mostly determined, presumably, big guys.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
In the coronal heating, it might have more sense.
Yeah, I'd like to get some handle on the, what the size means, you know. You've given us a figure for the rate of increase of mutual velocity, but how does that compare, for example, with the helicity in a prominence twisted up over a week or something? You know, how much helicity would that? What's the relative value? In other words, for example, if you had a large scale structure. Into which this helicity was being ejected, and suppose it was being spread out efficiently by coronal turbulence, then what difference would it make to the global structure? How long would it take to make a difference to the global structure to build up global helicity in the coronal?
Yeah, I can show up, put up some things that I already put up this work of Chase, if I can find it now. I seem to have lost it. This was the comparison of the mutual helicity fluxes and the self-helicity fluxes. And so this is sort of per pixel rate. And somewhere else I've got per square centimeter rates. There's a lot more mutual helicity flux by about five orders of magnitude than there is self-helicity flux. This rate, I suspect, is, say, three orders of magnitude down from an active region rate.
So does that
four orders of magnitude down?
You should just ignore the self-helicity flux for small elements then?
I don't think so. You have to be careful because active regions are not omnipresent, and there aren't that many of them. So that if you do a, I think Rick DeVore estimated the whole cycle differential rotation induced helicity injection rate in active regions to be something like 10 to the 45th Maxwell squared. And I've just said that if you do this, the mutual helicity flux in the quiet sun in one hemisphere, you get 10 to the 43rd. So it's at a 1% level or something like that. That you can ignore at this.
Yeah. So that's what you've shown, that you don't have to worry about that.
I think so. Now, granted, I don't have the most confidence in my inversion scheme. And that's a lot of the reason why I've talked with you guys today about self-helicity, not mutual helicity, because I'm pretty confident about this result. If you guys have any criticisms or ways to test the accuracy or anything like that, please grab me and let me know. Axel has suggested using his simulation, using the boundary condition on his simulation with my tracking algorithm, because he knows what the the helicity flux is, and I should be able to measure that too. So. Seems like a good idea.
There's one problem with that, is that, that most of the helicity flux I have seen from the simulations comes actually from the large scale field. And that's what it has an upward sound, and secondly, it has it's not larger. And that's a worry. So that means whenever we measure anything in this form, there's a much larger component to the ABCD flux.
Because I group things.
He could take his data and smear it out.
Well, the way I group things, I can actually bin it by. In fact, I did that for the mutualicity flux. I bin things by latitude. This was a check to see that things were rotating the relative rotation was in a right hand sense, and you can see that sort of curve from differential rotation. This is a histogram in flux of the contribution to the helicity flux. So most of the helicity flux is coming, mutual helicity flux is coming from small flux elements, not the larger fluxes in the distribution. But I can, as long as I'm grouping sources into large and small sources, I can just ignore contribution from larger sources. You're saying you might have a ubiquitous field, though, I think. So that's, I don't know how to interpret that. Anyway.
It's still varying over the size of the domain. But it's, and in order to calculate that, I think there will need some more information. And it's the, as we discussed, I need somehow the regular derivative to appear.
Okay, I'm
I have another question. I think one of the important features of prominences in coronal mass ejections is that they are, I believe, the way in which the corona gets rid of magnetic helicity that's stored up. Now, a key question is whether that helicity actually is just transported through the photosphere by emergence, or whether it's injected into the helicity by lots of small-scale neutral motions. And that's why I'd like to know, you know, just how big your mutual helicity injection rate is compared with the amount of helicity that you see in a part of the corona before it erupts. To put it in context.
Yes, you're right. Given a per square kilometer rate and a lifetime of a prominence, that would be trivial to calculate what the expected rate is.
I mean, a prominence, you know, sitting there for months and months, 8 months perhaps. So that's quiescent prominence is quite large. So there's, in principle, a possibility that it will gain a lot of diversity coming from below, depending on how much is coming through.
Mm-hmm. I think it probably also depends on whether you think that which turns into a CME springs up bodily from the from beneath the convection zone and just has to break out to get away, or whether it's actually assembled.
So, your calculations then pretty much rule out the idea that the helicity from prominences comes from the little magnetic elements in the quiet zone being moved around. Is that, can you rule that out?
No, because he hasn't said how big it is. Compared
moved around relative from self helicity.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Well, but you've got a potential number.
Yeah. So we could spend a few minutes calculating that now.
You use sort of discrete techniques.
Yes.
Is there some limitation?
The theory, of course, is quite general, and I think Che, when he did an active region, used a Fourier transform. You know, you can just take a Fourier transform of the field. If you want to keep track of what individual flux elements are doing, yeah, I think it's an advantage and a limitation. Yeah. For the quiet zone, I think it makes sense because you do really have, I think.
Yeah, it's certainly for ephemeral regions, it makes sense because we can count them by fingers.
Yeah.
And that's. Makes sense, but when you want to go to the future to apply a different structure, you might run in some overlaps and, you know.
Yeah, ways. Yeah. It's much less clear so to interpret what's going on.
Techniques.
It always seems like integral definitions, right, in the beginning.
That's true. And I got rid of the integrals with delta functions, so.
That's why zero can mean delta functions.
Are there any other questions for Brian? Thanks, Brian.